Welcome to another episode of the Debora Health Report, where we dive into current health and medical topics to keep the Delaware Valley informed and updated. Last month, we focused on diagnosing and treating valvular heart disease, the high-tech present of minimally invasive care at Debora Heart and Lung Center, and the exciting future in the heart valve research space. This month, we discuss hypertension, the medical term for high blood pressure, a condition where the force of blood against your artery walls is consistently too high. It's a major risk factor for serious health problems like heart disease, stroke, kidney failure, and other complications. We review how to keep it at bay, as well as treating and managing it after diagnosis. Here's Rasa Kay.
Hi, I'm Rasa Kay. In this podcast, we revisit hypertension, also known as high blood pressure. We're talking with Debora interventional cardiologist Dr. Richard Kovach, who's concerned that we're not taking this silent killer seriously enough. You hear our experts say it all the time, the sooner something's diagnosed, the better. But especially in conditions like hypertension, when the first symptoms tend to appear from its secondary effects and organ damage. Here's Dr. Kovach.
Hypertension really is one of those diseases that has incredible systemic effects when it's not managed properly. But until the later stages of the disease, until it starts to affect end organs, really does not have any typical symptoms. People are surprised very often that they even have hypertension. I feel fine. Nobody ever told me I had it. Hypertension can be present for many, many years, with patients being unaware of the adverse effects that it's causing on their body.
What could possibly be then early signs if you don't tend to notice it until it's starting to cascade?
Some of the early signs are also signs of perhaps other diseases or just things that we experience in our daily life. One of the signs is fatigue. Well, I think we're all tired these days. One of the signs is headaches, particularly if the blood pressure is severely elevated, but we all get headaches. Poor sleep patterns. Everybody's stressed out. We're not all, many of us are not sleeping well. Those sorts of things that we may not even notice. Even in the wintertime, we get nosebleeds from the dry air. You know, people complain about that all the time. The heat's on and the mucous membranes in the nose dry out and they get nosebleeds. But nosebleeds can also occur with high blood pressure, but we attribute it to something else. You know, I have a cold, the air is dry. And it went away, so it's fine.
What's happening when these symptoms show up? How is high blood pressure causing a nosebleed?
High blood pressure causing a nosebleed is literally because the pressure is so high that the small capillaries or small blood vessels in the nose are rupturing under the high pressure. And especially if the tissue in the nose is dried out and making the small vessels that are close to the surface more fragile just by being dry. But meanwhile, it's affecting numerous other organs, the brain, the heart, the kidneys, the eyes, much of it having to do with the way it affects particularly the blood vessels. When there is high blood pressure, it increases the stress on the blood vessel walls. Blood vessels reacting to that become stiffer, and actually you can sort of get into a roundabout situation where the blood vessels get stiffer. The blood pressure gets higher, the vessels get more stiff, the blood pressure gets higher. That stress on the blood vessels also damages the inner linings of the blood vessels. And the body's response to damage of the blood vessels is to start the process of atherosclerosis or deposition of cholesterol and eventually calcium in the blood vessels from that persistent high pressure. The same with the heart. When your blood pressure is high, your heart, in effect, becomes a bit of a weightlifter. It has to work harder to pump against that high blood pressure. Often the heart muscle will thicken. The heart muscle will do something what we call remodel. The heart muscle itself, when it becomes thicker, becomes stiffer. It also, over a period of time, that increased stress on the heart muscle can then in turn start to weaken the heart muscle and eventually lead to heart failure from untreated hypertension because it's sort of gone up the curve in thickness and working harder, but then it's taxing the heart muscle for many years, the heart muscle starts to fail because of that increased stress over so many years. In the brain, where the blood vessels are more fragile, you can get what we call microinfarcts that can affect your memory and cognitive abilities. When atherosclerosis occurs from high blood pressure in the carotid arteries, which go up to the brain, that can cause a deposition of cholesterol plaque, narrowing of the blood vessels. The cholesterol plaque in the carotid arteries, it particularly is, for lack of a better word, more fragile than plaques, say, in the arteries in the legs or the arteries in the heart. And bits of that plaque or clot can break off and travel north and cause a stroke. You can have microhemorrhages in your eyes, which damage your eyesight. You can have high blood pressure causing loss of your kidney function. You start to use the little areas of the kidneys that filter blood called the glomeruli. You can start losing glomeruli from the high blood pressure, which impairs your kidney's ability to filter the blood. That in turn causes another cycle. When you're not filtering the blood and not producing a normal amount of urine, you tend to hold on to fluid and salt, which raises your blood pressure more, another vicious cycle that can occur. The higher your blood pressure goes, the more kidney damage you get. There's another mechanism, sort of a feedback mechanism, between the brain and the kidneys. The brain and the kidneys talk to each other. The kidneys are intimately involved in the control of your blood pressure. There's a neurologic feedback loop between the brain and the kidneys. Sometimes that feedback loop can become unregulated or out of control. And that in turn also can continue to raise your blood pressure.
The systemic implications for elevated blood pressure are just massive.
Absolutely massive. In fact, hypertension is the number one cause of global disease burden in the world. One of the charts I have in one of my presentations says by the year 2025, well, it is 2025 now, about 1.59 billion people in the world will be considered hypertensive. Getting back to your question about being the silent killer, it's only about 70% of people who have hypertension are even aware that they have hypertension. Only about 60% of that 70% are being treated, and only about 30% of those being treated are actually being controlled. So it's another cascading event that's going on right now. If you look at population health, we were doing pretty well until about 2010. We were improving hypertension control. Between 2010 and 2014, we kind of leveled off. And ever since 2014, our management and control of hypertension has started to tank. In other words, we're becoming less and less good at controlling hypertension. The control of hypertension is falling off.
But also the numbers that we look at have changed some. So we were considering hypertension to be starting at kind of a higher number in 2014 when the drop-off started. But when we lower that number, doesn't that mean we're going to find more hypertension?
I think yes and no. I think we're understanding more about hypertension when damage to the blood vessels and when damage to, you know, the various organs that we already talked about starts to occur. So I think we're learning much more about that. Yes, the definition of what's a normal blood pressure has changed, but not in proportion to the number of people that are now being considered hypertensive. We know that being overweight contributes to hypertension. Over 60% of the country is considered to be overweight, and a high percentage of the country is considered to be morbidly obese. So that's contributing to that. Watching TV in the evening, and I watch all the food advertisements, and, you know, especially fast foods and convenience foods. You know, all these foods have, especially convenience foods, have high levels of salt in them. I'm not convinced that salt consumption is decreasing. In fact, it's probably increasing based on our lifestyles and our stress and bad eating habits and things like that.
All right, so let's talk about the numbers and what they mean.
Okay. What's considered normal blood pressure is roughly 120 over 80. That's considered normal. 121 to 130 over 80 is considered elevated. 131 to 139 over 80 to 90 or 80 to 89 is considered stage 1 hypertension. 131 to 140 or greater, and greater than 90 or greater, is considered stage 2 hypertension. What we know about hypertension is that for every 20 over 10 increase in your systolic and diastolic blood pressure, there's a doubling of your cardiovascular risk. So for instance, if your blood pressure is 115 over 75, if your blood pressure increases to 135 over 85, I'm just making sure I'm doing my math properly here, it essentially doubles your cardiovascular risk. If you go from 135 over 85 to 155 over 95, it quadruples your mortality rate. So, you know, the concept that, hey, my blood pressure is pretty good, it's 140 over 80, 85, your blood pressure is not under control. And we need to think about what it's doing to your body, even though you may not have any symptoms. As we age, the blood vessels become less soft and less elastic. Normally, when the heart pumps, you know, that pressure wave goes through the blood vessels, and the blood vessels expand and contract to that pressure wave because they're elastic. As we age, those blood vessels become stiffer. Instead of pumping through a soft rubber pipe, you're pumping through a lead pipe as the vessels stiffen. Or very often that's recognized as isolated systolic hypertension, where, you know, the low number may be where it's supposed to be, but the high number is 160, 170, 180, even when the low number is 60 or 70. And that's because the vessels become less elastic and are unable to dilate and contract with that pressure wave as the heart pumps.
What do those numbers indicate to you in terms of your approach?
Perhaps dictate which medications you're going to choose. Put patients on medications that help their heart pump less forcefully to lower the higher number. It is a more difficult situation in management. You know, how do you lower the higher number without lowering the lower number as well?
We talked a lot about heart valve disease recently. How can high blood pressure lead to aortic valve disease?
Well, we need to talk about two aspects of aortic valve disease. Just to clarify for the audience, the aortic valve is the valve that separates the left ventricle, which is the main pumping chamber of your heart, from the aorta, which is the main blood vessel in your body. All this increased stress on the tissues from high blood pressure can, for lack of a better term, accelerate the aging of the aortic valve, cause that valve to become damaged more easily and specifically more calcified earlier on. And that can lead to what we call aortic stenosis, meaning instead of that valve opening properly, it's sort of like a door that has stuck hinges. You know, it's not opening properly. When you develop aortic stenosis, that also makes the heart have to work harder to generate very high pressures to overcome that stiff valve. That in turn can damage the heart muscle over time and lead to heart failure. The other form of aortic valve disease is called aortic insufficiency, where the valve leaks between each beat. The valve doesn't close properly, so blood rushes back into the main pumping chamber of the heart from the aorta. That also makes the heart have to work harder. You can actually have aortic insufficiency with aortic stenosis because the valve is deformed. Back to the door analogy, it's a creaky old door that doesn't open properly, but it also doesn't close properly. So it's letting in the draft. It's letting the blood flow back. But also, severe uncontrolled hypertension can dilate or enlarge your aorta. That can also dilate what we call the aortic root, where the valve is located, and separate the valve leaflets, causing aortic insufficiency. So it can lead to both those problems with the aortic valve over time.
We talked about some valve disease issues that are just basically they wear out. Right. But when you have the high blood pressure situation, you're speeding up that process.
You're speeding up that process, exactly.
So if somebody's coming to you with these early symptoms, that's a great thing because the earlier you catch it, the better.
When you're managing somebody with hypertension, the first step is, well, to take that step back is make sure they are hypertensive. And it's not typically just one blood pressure measurement. You know, a lot of people have what we call white coat syndrome. You know, they come into the doctor, they see this white coat, and their blood pressure goes sky high because they're nervous about being there. So you want to take the blood pressure, number one, in both arms. Sometimes one arm can be different than the other, and that can have to do with a blockage of blood flow to one of the arms, and that's a whole different subject. You want to have multiple readings over the course of time. Let the patient calm down in the office, take the blood pressure at the beginning of the visit, take the blood pressure once you've had a chance to talk to them, calm them down, take their blood pressure again. You may want to consider doing something called an ambulatory blood pressure monitoring program, have them take their blood pressure at home. So you want to determine that they actually have consistently elevated high blood pressure. And also, in addition to the physical exam, comes a good history. Do they live a stressful lifestyle? What are their eating habits? What is their salt intake? What is their family history? Do they get enough sleep? Do they get enough exercise? Things that may be contributing to hypertension. In any disease state, before you start adding on medications or considering other forms of therapy, the first option is always to consider your non-medical options. Change your dietary habits. Reduce your salt intake. Reducing salt intake, by the way, also requires a lot of education. People say, you know, I try to eat well. I'll have a can of soup for lunch. A can of soup. Well, you might as well just eat a whole salt shaker full of salt if you're eating canned soups. I eat a sandwich every lunch, you know, with lettuce and tomato on it. Well, where do you get your meat? Oh, it's, you know, from the deli. Deli meats have lots of salt in them. Whatever you're buying at the grocery store, you know, check the contents of how much salt is in there.
You know, sodium. It's listed as sodium.
Sodium, yes. Yeah, sodium is salt. Okay. Salt is sodium. Well, there are many different kinds of salts, but it's sodium salt that we're talking about. Baked goods often have a lot of salt in them, not to mention a lot of sugar. Drinks, sodas have salt in them and a high sugar content. So you really need to be careful about what you're eating. Diet that's high in fruits and vegetables, that's high in good fats like olive oil or avocado, good proteins, chicken, tofu, those sorts of things. But the first and easiest step is limiting your salt intake. The second thing is, getting back to non-pharmacologic, is sleep. We know that poor sleep is associated with hypertension.
Here's the thing about the sleep, though. That's another chicken and egg.
Exactly.
What's the interplay? You know, if you've got bad sleep, that can lead to hypertension. But if you've got hypertension, that can lead to bad sleep.
That's a great question. That's something that, quite frankly, is not entirely well understood. One of the theories is that normally when you're asleep, and when you're in good sleep, when you're in REM sleep, you have a nocturnal dip in your blood pressure. Normally, your blood pressure should dip 10 to 15 millimeters of mercury while you're asleep. And if that doesn't happen, one of the theories is, if you're not getting good sleep, if your blood pressure is staying at its baseline and not, the theory is, conditioning your blood vessels to relax and expand and relax and expand, they stay constricted, which then maybe long-term impairs your blood vessels' ability to relax. Blood vessels are the main blood vessels, including the resistance blood vessels, the smaller blood vessels, have muscular walls. And if those muscles don't relax and stay tight, that creates what we call significant resistance or peripheral vascular resistance. The higher the resistance, the less compliant the blood vessels become, and the higher the blood pressure goes. We know also, for instance, that if you have sleep apnea, that's also associated with hypertension. But again, it's that chicken and egg, which causes which. With sleep apnea, it's probably the fact that you're not getting good sleep. You're constantly waking up, never getting to the good sleep. Sleep also reduces stress in general. As I said, it's not completely well understood.
Okay, coffee. Number one, does the caffeine add to whatever, a stress reaction? And I mean, is coffee a problem? If we take it out of the equation of messing your sleep up, but just having coffee, is that a factor, the caffeine for hypertension?
Yeah, caffeine is a vasoconstrictor. In other words, it makes the vessels clamp down. That's also can be sort of a vicious cycle with stress and lifestyle. The more stressed you are, the more coffee you drink, the poorer your diet becomes. You don't exercise as much. You're taking energy drinks. You may get into some really bad habits, including alcohol or other drugs, all contributing to that together. So it's hypertension. There's not one cause and one effect. It's really a multifactorial disease. There's so many things contributing to it. And it's not like, well, I have hypertension, so I'm going to take my medications and I can still go eat three cheesesteaks and eat a bag of potato chips and not exercise and drink 12 cups of coffee a day. There are multiple aspects, multiple things that contribute to hypertension that need to be managed in order to effectively control it.
That's Deborah interventional cardiologist Dr. Richard Kovach. Join us for the next part of this conversation about high blood pressure, where we explore treatments and management. It's available the first Wednesday of next month. I'm Rasa Kay.
You can always listen to all of the informative Deborah Doctor interviews at DeborahHealthReport.com. Schedule an appointment at DemandDeborah.org.